Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Synesthesia Experience, Tasting Words, Seeing Music, and Hearing Color by Maureen Seberg, narrated by Rachel Perry. Foreword. Bob Dylan's song, Chimes of Freedom, was my first introduction to the phenomenon of synesthesia, and I didn't even realize it at the time. At least, you could put it that way. I was a teenager, around 19 years old, and not officially a synesthete. And I was listening to this song on my record player, some of you may remember those, as I had done many times before. But this time, I was particularly absorbed, and I had already started developing what I'll call a literary or artistic consciousness. This time, I was suddenly and unexpectedly gripped by the effects of the lyrics and the music of the song for the first time. I experienced goosebumps and sensations on the back of my neck. My heart rate jumped, and I felt quite viscerally as though I were riding a wave. When the song ended, I went back and replayed it a number of times, re-experiencing that aesthetic thrill. I checked out the other songs/poems and found similar experiences with a number of them. I did not at the time attempt to explain to myself what could have caused me to have such a powerful experience. After having this and other powerful experiences inspired by poetry and other art forms, I later came to understand that the intense poetic effectiveness of this song/poem came from a number of poetic techniques or devices, including Dylan's extremely effective use of celestial and sky imagery, lightning, thunder, wild ripping hail, clouds and cracks in the sky. His deliberately rapid and disjointed oscillation between ecstatic and terrifying apocalyptic scenarios. His use of the deep, ancient associations of bells, religious, mystical, royal, nuptial. His Dante-esque cataloging of human suffering. His collapsing and expanding of time and space. And, perhaps most importantly, his use of the powerful poetic device of literary synesthesia, the ecstatic blending of senses, or perhaps the psychotic breakdown of their normally rigid division. In this case, of course, where bells cast shadows in sound, and where the flashing of chimes is simultaneously heard and gazed upon. I have long since given up the literary and poetic aspirations that the work of Bob Dylan and other poets inspired in me, leaving that to more capable hands. Though I have entered a field that I consider to be no less important, the personal, scientific, and scholarly study of the world's mystical traditions, which has obvious connections to poetry and, as I have recently discovered, to the subject of synesthesia. I have been engaged for some years in the exploration of and investigation into the effects of meditation and related yogic practices, breath control, postural control, ascetic practice, etc., especially on long-term, full-time advanced practitioners. More specifically, I have recently been focusing on the effects of such practices on the sensory perceptual capacities of advanced, adept, or virtuoso practitioners, especially those in the Indo-Tibetan tradition. I have been incredibly fortunate to have collaborated with Professor Robert Thurman, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and a number of leading scientists, scholars, and practitioners in this work. I am now further zeroing in on the claims by these traditions that certain meditative practices can lead to radically enhanced sensory perceptual functioning. My orientation is an integrative, cross-cultural, interdisciplinary one. And I look within contemporary Western science, now actually cosmopolitan science, as it is an enterprise done by people from all over the world, and scholarship for possible bridges between science and these meditation traditions. I am beginning to discover some preliminary, yet fascinating, extraordinary scientific support for such claims. It is at this time, while affiliated with MIT and working at Tibet House in New York City, that my boss, Gandan Thurman, son of Professor Robert Thurman, brother of the extraordinary actress Uma, and longtime friend of the Dalai Lama, told me about his having recently been contacted by a friend and colleague, Maureen Seberg, a freelance writer for the New York Times and other publications, who was working on a book about the phenomenon of synesthesia. Gandan, though younger than I, has been like a mentor and guide in the world of Tibetan Buddhism and many other subjects. So when he emphasized the importance of working with this writer/researcher, the implicit high level of respect impressed me. I was aware that synesthesia was associated with my field of inquiry, but my awareness was not detailed or substantial. Nevertheless, I offered to help in any way I could. From the first time I spoke to Maureen, which lasted about 3 hours, I became aware that I was off on a new intellectual, artistic, scientific, and spiritual adventure of discovery. I was immediately inspired by her extraordinary enthusiasm and passion for this subject of inquiry, and for all the subjects to which it is critically related. Virtually all forms of artistic and literary endeavor, psychology and neuroscience, the philosophy of mind and consciousness, religion, mysticism, and spirituality, and even physics and quantum mechanics. During this period of time in which I have been privileged to collaborate with her on aspects of the project, I have been profoundly impressed time and again by the spectrum of areas of inquiry in which she has demonstrated not only wide-ranging knowledge, but penetrating insight and the ability to tie together facts that, at first glance, appear disparate, even irrelevant and disconnected. In doing so, she has wound up inevitably trespassing on the borders of sectarian and specialized interests that characterize our present intellectual age, a time in which many seek to protect their narrowly focused domains by reflexive criticism and dismissal of those possessing an open-minded and open-hearted spirit of inquiry. With those rare few who were not won over by her rare gift of graciousness and genuine persuasiveness, Maureen has been unwilling to compromise regarding this interdisciplinary approach, and especially regarding what she considers to be the essentially transcendent nature of synesthesia. Is it any wonder, then, that Maureen's quest for knowledge about this unique brain gift takes her on a journey from darkness to light, and from the mundane to the sublime? Go with her on her quest for understanding, prompted by her own chimes of freedom flashing, an epiphanic and light-filled moment of clarity about synesthesia while writing of a dark and horrible crime. Participate, as I have, as she gets the cooperation of rock and rap stars, composers and painters, neuroscientists and physicists, lamas and Kabbalists, on her quest for the truth. Stand with her in the Guggenheim. Listen to Itzhak Perlman's virtuoso performance with the New York Philharmonic. Watch the dust devils swirl along the road in Tucson, Arizona. Smell the fry bread at a Native American reservation. And kneel with her alongside Brahmins as she leaves no stone unturned in the search for answers. And perhaps most remarkably, close your eyes and imagine the beautiful and delicate sensations of synesthesia she and her fellow synesthetes painstakingly describe along the way. Dr. William C. Bushell, PhD, Director of East-West Research for Tibet House. Introduction. I don't remember when the colors began. They've always been with me, like the beat of my own heart or the sound of my own breath. Science teaches that I was likely a fetus when my brain started forming the extra connections, or began to have the lack of chemical inhibition that would enhance my world, creating a beautiful watercolor that only I could see. A technicolor alphabet and numbers and days of the week, as well as colored months and music, would be my experience in life. I would have synesthesia, a blending of the senses, to go with my auburn hair, green eyes, left-handedness, and need for braces. I believed this was normal for the first several years of life, as I learned the alphabet and numbers and how to use a calendar and play the piano. The internal wiring began to express itself in my graphemes, or symbols, as well as in the days of the week and names of the months. It didn't occur to me at first that other people didn't enjoy their letters the way I did, with all their swirling, attendant hues. That's the thing about life. If something's always been your reality, how do you know it's different for other people? When I eventually spoke of my impressions as a child, I quickly learned that my perceptions were not common. In fact, they were regarded as strange. Like many synesthetes around the world, I learned to keep them to myself. I'm grateful for the present-day climate of inquiry and wonder about this shy and deeply personal gift. The experience of synesthesia is quite beautiful and, I believe, miraculous. There is evidence that meditative adepts, particularly those of the Tibetan and Zen Buddhist traditions, experience synesthesia in their meditations. Recently, it has also been induced in hypnotized subjects. Synesthetes are also natural empaths who sometimes literally feel the pain of others due to the mirror touch neurons recently discovered in their brains. I noticed this as a reporter at accident scenes, and still do to this day, even when reading about people suffering in distant locales. Too late, I would learn that this also means that synesthetes should be very careful of their environments. But all of these astonishing discoveries were made well into my adulthood. Like all synesthetes of my generation, I learned as a child not to speak of the strange, if ethereal and beautiful, tableau before my eyes. As I write this as an adult and a journalist, the words I type still retain their spectrums. I can either choose to focus on the colors for each letter, which creates a lot of noise and slows my typing pace, or I can glance past them. Sometimes, when I go back to do a rewrite, whereas some people will correct alliteration, I will correct an over-representation of a certain color. I also sometimes substitute words, going to a thesaurus to find one that better decorates my phrases. It used to be frustrating when Microsoft Word underlined, in red, the words synesthesia and synesthetes because it didn't recognize them. That is no longer the case, and a sign of the newfound awareness of an interest in the traits. I know the ink is black in my newspapers and books, but I see much more than that. Sometimes my colors radiate outward in front of the actual characters, and sometimes they just create an inner recognition of each color in my mind. If you placed a sheet of cellophane on top of this page, with a different color for each of the letters, the result would be a pretty close approximation of what I see. I'd feel colorblind without it. There are definitely moments when it's more pronounced. I'll never forget my junior high school typing class and the letters spilling forth from the page like so many cans of luminous paint. Teal K's, terracotta R's, indigo H's, scarlet E's. Colored music often also dazzles me. I recently discovered my motion-to-hearing synesthesia thanks to an online test. The test showed balls of light streaming toward the center of the screen and then receding. As I looked at them, I heard the sound of rushing water, even though there was no audio. There are other challenges in navigating the world as a synesthete. I find sometimes that the color of an object is either perfect or distracting. For example, a Toyota Prius looks best in pale green or gray, but black really bothers me. Cash registers should not be industrial gray or beige, but fire engine red. Dresses that drape a certain way should be one color and not another, and so on. I don't wish to impose my synesthesia aesthetic on others, however. Most synesthetes are grounded in reality, and I know that not everyone feels as I do. My synesthesia is not usually an annoyance or a hindrance, however. It seldom overtakes the task at hand. I see it as additional information, rather than a replacement for the main information I need to function properly. It is mostly a welcome background impression, a kind of music that is always with me. Anyone who likes multitasking or studying with music on in the background would understand that my synesthetic multitasking is not only possible, but very human. It is no different for me as a synesthete. It is just life, but it is life with a volume knob. It fades to the softest impressions when I need to concentrate on something else. But if I choose to focus on it, it can swell like the crescendos of a lovely movie soundtrack. I lived in ignorance of what to call these impressions for a couple of decades, until the day I wandered, almost trance-like, into an Imaginarium store in a mall. I don't know what guided me in there, but it was just as though a hand were pushing me from behind. I was 27, there on a table, in the front left-hand side of the store next to the register, was a book whose multicolored title on a white background jumped out at me immediately. The title was The Man Who Tasted Shapes, and it was by Dr. Richard Cytoic. I intuited what it meant immediately. I read the inside flaps to be sure, and walked the two short steps to the register to pay for it. I still get chills thinking about that moment of serendipity. The next day, I phoned Dr. Cytoic, the neuroscientist who helped White House Press Secretary James Brady in the wake of the attempted assassination of President Ronald Reagan. I wanted to do a story about him at my first newspaper job, a small daily. He was so charming. He gave me the interview and even told me about other synesthetes living in New York City. I set about to find these soulmates living in my community and pulled a few local artists, intuitively suspecting that they were also tribe members. I found one on the third try and included her in the report. But as a good newspaper woman, I had to leave myself out of the mix. Dr. Cytoic's book opened the floodgates. I snapped up several other engaging books, secretly harboring a desire to contribute my own. I would learn that more than 100 years ago, synesthesia was not only known, it was chic. Illuminated color organs that paired notes with specific colors were once booming in auditoriums and salons. French symbolists such as Arthur Rimbaud and Charles Baudelaire were writing poetry replete with synesthetic impressions. And Charles Darwin's cousin, Sir Francis Galton, was studying people who had a unique ability to blend their senses. Synesthesia's history may be lost to some, but it still plucks at the strings of time in libraries around the world. There, you can learn that somewhere in a Weimar rehearsal hall, German composer Franz Liszt corrected his orchestra. "Please, gentlemen, a little bluer, if you please. This key demands it." Richard Wagner stormed off the stage during a rehearsal of Tristan and Isolde because, in the maestro's eyes, the set's colors were all wrong. They didn't match his expectations, given the music he'd written. His royal benefactor agreed, and the opera opened with the new set. Illuminated color organs, such as the one used for Scriabin's Prometheus, Poem of Fire, once lit the stage and ignited imaginations. And the earlier, yet futuristic, 18th century Clavecin de Couleur, an illuminated harpsichord, caused audible gasps among corseted onlookers. Despite art's fashionable love affair with the gift, synesthesia suddenly dropped off the radar around the time that psychiatrists began emphasizing behaviorism and shying away from inner experience as a focus. It didn't return again until great modern researchers such as Dr. Larry Marks of Yale and Dr. Richard Cytowic took up the cause in recent decades. Now, modern brain imaging machines hum and buzz and gurgle out rainbow images of the brain of synesthetes, proving unequivocally that this is no artistic conceit. Synesthetes' brains are different. They light up in two sensory or conceptual areas when only one sense is stimulated. So, as maddening as this 100-year gap of interest in synesthesia is, new research is currently burgeoning. I take pride in learning that the gift is up to 8 times more common in those in the arts, according to leading neuroscientist and author of Phantoms of the Brain, Dr. V.S. Ramachandran of the University of California at San Diego. Scientists are constantly discovering new types, and the diversity of its expression is evident in the synesthetes I spoke with in my research for this book. Synesthesia ends up being a large, colorful umbrella with great and varied wonders beneath it. Although interest in synesthesia has ebbed and flowed over time, its genetic expression has endured. It survived because it has a hidden agenda, Dr. Ramachandran has said, comparing it to how the sickle cell anemia gene protects people from malaria. Synesthesia is about 8 times more common among artists, writers, poets, and creative people. If you assume that there is greater cross-wiring and concepts are located in different parts of the brain, then it's going to create a greater propensity toward metaphorical thinking and creativity in people with synesthesia, he said in a TED lecture. He later explained to me he would not go so far as to say the synesthesia gene is the creativity gene, but rather that it lays a foundation for creativity. The reason it was preserved through evolution and natural selection is because it makes some people metaphorical and link ideas and be creative. You need this whole spectrum of human diversity. Knowing that the experts have already had their say, it was beginning to occur to me that my quest should be to find the most prominent synesthetes in the world to talk about it. I'd done a lot of profiles on famous people throughout the years and witnessed firsthand their ability to bring a lot of attention to any topic they touched. A book that included the celebrated would certainly raise awareness of the gift. And though traditional medicine fascinated me, and research on the topic was finally picking up speed, I knew I must also call on consciousness experts. As someone who lives inside the experience, I knew that anatomy alone did not, could not, hold all the answers. In fact, many times, it didn't even know the right questions to ask. There were beautiful moments along this journey. Dr. Stuart Hameroff invited members of the American Synesthesia Association to his conference in Tucson, after we spoke about synesthesia and consciousness. While inviting me to hear her play at Lincoln Center one special night, jazz legend Marion McPartland admitted that she'd never heard the word synesthesia in her 91 years, even though each of her musical keys has a color. The great violinist Itzhak Perlman joked with me that the reason my Tuesdays are golden is because Monday is over. Tibet House medical anthropologist Dr. Bill Bushell, on a quest of his own to know the inner worlds of adept meditators, found synesthesia a fascinating aspect of that process, and a camaraderie grew from our parallel searches. Finally, doctors began to admit their own synesthetic moments and not only share their knowledge, but also talk about what was not yet known and left to find. The general goodwill shored me up to continue on my quest. It is a fabulous, creative tribe I feel fortunate to belong to. This book seeks to explore and celebrate the experiences of many people who know the phenomenon as part of their lives and work. My hope is that this will inspire those with different minds of all kinds to embrace their uniqueness and use it in their creative endeavors. Perhaps it will help the scientists who now study the gift get more funding by popularizing the phenomena. Perhaps a child in India experiencing it will one day know that the quintessential American songwriter Billy Joel thinks that certain music is azure too. And perhaps it will help usher in a new artistic renaissance to accompany the strong scientific one that is now underway. The book's tenor is not only scientific, but artistic and spiritual as well. Multiple Grammy Award-winning producer Pharrell Williams believes that synesthesia is a communion with God. Dr. Bushell, a leading medical anthropologist, told me that ancient Buddhist texts imply there is no enlightenment without synesthesia. And Sir Robert Caillou, the world-renowned engineer who settled on www as a name for the internet because W is green on his synesthetic palette, says it's simply faulty wiring, an engineering glitch of the brain. But when he needs to remember something, his colors seem to act as a mnemonic device to retrieve information. A happy glitch, then. The beauty of the individual testimonies in this book is that they are the subject's truths, as only someone who knows the gift intimately can speak about it. Many of them are speaking at length about it for the first time. Their words about such an ineffable experience helped me find my own. So the confused little girl has found community and some answers. But there are many more people out there still waiting, particularly children who may not have born into sympathetic or knowledgeable families. But now, my quest has produced role models, people who've not only succeeded with synesthesia, but who actually use it to inform their world-class art and their science. And for the first time, I advance the theory that synesthesia is nothing short of grace, evidenced by the Buddhist belief that it must be present at enlightenment. Indeed, according to two scientists I interview, the colorful forms that synesthetes see, the photisms, may actually be a form of quantum awareness. So, there is much ground to cover. Finding the right words to describe the ineffable has been the biggest part of my challenge. I'm reminded of Plato's allegory of the
sample complete. Ready to continue?